Good morning. Did you guys sleep okay? Yeah? I slept really well. I have four kids and two dogs, and I wake up at 5:30 every day, like it or not. I'm a night owl, though, so it's problematic because I often go to bed past 1 o'clock, and my family wakes me up, and so I come to retreats, and I get to sleep in until like 8. 8 o'clock is like noon to me. When I get to sleep till 8, I wake up feeling like I rose from the dead, and it was really good sleeping this morning. Well, I wanna bring a message this morning that is called "Search Me, O God," and it comes from a very familiar psalm. It's filled with phrases that you probably already heard, maybe even memorized. And this is another one of those messages that really. Most of the messages I preach at retreats are messages that did a great work in my own life first. And this is one that is still bearing fruit for me in my Christian journey. I'm going to read the passage for you. Here's what it says, okay? "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. And see if there be any grievous way in me. Lead me in the way everlasting." The whole psalm is worth reading, but I want to narrow down to these two verses so that we're not going all the way to lunchtime. And there's something amazing about when the Spirit of God is at work, because I don't discuss with the praise team at the retreat what I'm going to be speaking, but then the songs just perfectly fit what's about to come. And that's one of those affirmations for me that the Holy Spirit is already plowing the soil, is at work. When they led us in the song, "Here's my heart, O Lord, speak what is true." I was like, somebody is spying on my room. What's going on? How do you possibly know? That's really at the heart of what we're going to be talking about this morning. If you think about this passage, okay, "Search me, O God, and know my heart," exclamation point. That's a really weird request to make of an omniscient God. A God who already knows everything, why on earth does he require my invitation or permission to know me or to search me? Am I saying to God, hey, you don't know anything about me, but come on in and search my heart and maybe you'll learn something new today, God? He does not need our invitation to go there, to dig into our hearts, to know what is real. And so then begs the question, why even bother saying such a thing to God? For what purpose do we invite God to search our hearts and to know us? Well, I can create a parallel. That's why I have the image of the stethoscope there. Why do you go to a doctor? And by the way, any of you on a pre-med track hope to be doctors someday? Yeah, it's lonely out there. Lonely. When I was in college, like 50% of my class was pre-med. By junior year, very few were still pre-med, but you know, I think being a physician is a good pursuit. It's a little different today than it was when I was younger. But why do you go to see a doctor? Why do you take your clothing off and let them poke and prod at you and stick things in places they don't belong? Why do you let them do that? Is it because the doctor's lying awake at home at night with a burning curiosity about your physical condition? Do you think their doctors at home going, I can't sleep. I'm wondering if Dave is doing okay physically. He doesn't care. As long as I pay my bills, he's not losing any sleep over whether I'm well or I'm sick. I don't go to the doctor so that, fine, take a look. Get rid of your curiosity, brother. Examine me so you can finally know how I'm. It's not for him that I go. Even though I invite him to look at me in places that no one else looks, I do it because I need to know something about myself. It's not for his benefit, but for my own that I invite the examination, because if he doesn't look at me, there are things affecting me, possibly even killing me, which I am in absolute ignorance of. And so I invite his examination because my own survival and my own health absolutely depend on what he tells me next. So let me tell you a story about my earlier life. In 1973, any of you actually alive in 1973? Wow. Okay, so I'm officially old. 1973, my family, we were living in Beaverton, Oregon, before the Nike Corporation was even an idea in Phil Knight's mind. And It was pristine, untouched, unspoiled Pacific Northwest. And there were these mountains and these forests. And my brother and I used to walk all over the place down these winding roads. It was like countryside out there. Lumber yards and countryside and a few apartments and a Safeway store. That's pretty much what was in Beaverton at the time. And it was a different day. There weren't like all these psycho serial killers and child molesters prowling the streets. It was like living in Mayberry. My parents would just let us walk out the door, and we'd be gone until way past sunset. Sometimes we'd come in at like 9:30 at night. And I was young. I was about 6 years old at the time. But I remember one time we're walking down this little country road around a hill, a bend, and all of a sudden we heard this, you know, this little engine noise, and a car that looked pretty much like this, like a 73 Volkswagen Beetle, came tearing around. I was actually alive when this was a new car. So yes, I'm old. This thing comes tearing around the corner, not this actual car, but a similar car like this. And he's going way too fast for the road, and he doesn't see us, and my brother and I got so shocked, and I remember falling down in surprise, and then the car ran over my legs and kept driving. And the guy stopped for a second, looked in his rearview mirror, and took off. And I remember feeling no pain, getting up, shaking it off. It was a miracle. Just walked home. Okay? I mean, it was miraculous. I've told that story dozens of times because it's a big part of when I first recognized that someone's protecting me. It's the first time that I began understanding some of the Bible stories that my mom told us about a God who watches over people, because it's the first time I actually experienced a miracle. And so I've told that story dozens of times. One time I was telling the story where my brother happened to be in the room, and afterwards he came over to me and said, "You stupid idiot. That was me that got run over by the car, not you." And see, the thing about it is my brother has this freakish memory. He remembers what we ordered at the airport in Korea before we moved. He was 3 years old. He remembers what the sign looked like, what the airplane smelled like, what we were wearing. And he'll tell my mom, and my mom's freaking out, like, "How do you remember all this detail?" My brother has almost like an idiot savant's memory for our past. So when he said, "It was me that got run over," instantly I was like, whoosh, I was in a vortex, everything was blurry. I'm like, "Oh my gosh, he's right." All this, no wonder I felt no pain. No memory of the sensation of being run over, because it wasn't even my legs. Because the one thing you got right is I walked away from that. And I felt no pain, and it was a miracle. It just wasn't your miracle. It was my miracle. Now, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I don't understand the complex reason why my brain put me in that place rather than him. I don't think it was a desire to get attention. I think it was a noble big brother's desire to protect his kid brother from trauma. At least I like to think so. Okay? But what scared me the most about that moment was that for years a story had been repeated, which was then part of my own folklore, my own story. And it was so true to me that I began building auxiliary memories around it that weren't even real. And what terrified me was such an important story from my childhood was built entirely on misremembering the truth. And that scared me, because if my own memories are that unreliable, how much of anything that runs through this head of mine is real? How honest a person really am I? If my own memories betray me, and it only took one cross-examination from my brother to bring the truth to my life in a shattering way, it made me wonder, how much of our lives are we going through believing and rehearsing stories that are true to us, but simply not true? How often do you really submit your version of life to cross-examination? And what I found in nearly 20 years of pastoring the same church is that most people I know, including myself, we are woefully unaware of the truth. We walk through life with very little true self-awareness because we spend so little time really examining and being examined. We take things and with the strength of feeling, we construct a truth, an entire life story around one perspective, one form of thinking about it, and no one is ever allowed to question whether my version of it is true or not. And so I will pastor people who come from the same family, and one sibling will tell me, my childhood was hell on earth. And the other sibling will tell me, my sibling was spoiled, and I always got the raw end of the short end of the stick. I'm thinking, how can such extreme statements both be true? That one sibling felt like they were abused and that their family upbringing was hell on earth. And the other sibling thought, my brother was the lucky one. We had a great family, but he always got the best of everything. I got nothing. And as I'm listening to them, I'm thinking, well, maybe there's some subjective truth to the way they saw it. But I don't think there's very much of objective truth in what they remembered. They probably seized on 4 or 5 important events and built an entire folklore of their childhood around those radicalized events. And if they had been slow and paused and been examined, I think God would have shown them that there was more to their story than even they knew. That even in the worst moments, God was present at work. There were moments of redeeming grace and goodness. But they can't see that because pain has soured and closed their hearts. And so I think it absolutely matters that we carve out time and space in our lives to sit before somebody else to be examined. Now, it can be of some value to be cross-examined by friends, but I think the greatest value comes when you carve out time to really just sit before God and let him examine you. I think that's what David is doing when he says, search me, O God, know my heart. Try me, know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me. What he's saying is, God, I think that there may be poisons in me I don't even know about. And I'm inviting you now to come root around deeply inside of me, in places I don't even want anyone to go, to show me what might be silently sucking the life out of me, robbing me of everything I'm supposed to have in this life. Here's why it matters so much. Proverbs 4:23, I've just presented in 3 different translations. It essentially says the same thing. Above all else, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. Here's what the ESV says. Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flows the springs of life. Here's the NLT, the New Living Translation. Above all else, guard your heart, for it affects everything you do. The argument for keeping a close watch over the condition of your heart, of making sure your heart lives in a context of the truth, is because out of your heart, every other thing in your life that is called life flows out. Your relationships, your career, your sense of well-being, your body morphology, your longevity, your countenance. Have you ever met someone with a permanent scowl? They look like they were born ticked off. You're like, wow, just looking at you puts me in a worse mood. You've got like this permanent tattooed, life sucks face. Where did that come from? No one's born like that. Every baby knows how to smile. But out of your heart flows everything, including your mug. The way your face looks is a window for everybody else. And not when you're trying. It's when nobody's looking. You're just like that. That's your average default face when they're taking crowd photos and I don't look like that. Yeah, actually, that's how you look all the time. Except when you know we're taking a picture, then you know, you get that smile on. But everybody knows 90% of the time your face is a window to your heart. And I see people who, when you just look over and they're not even being observed, they're like totally oblivious. They're smiling, like, oh, life is so. And you're like, I see your heart. I see your heart, because even when no one's looking, your face flows out of your heart, doesn't it? everything. The way that your partner, if you're in a relationship, the way your boyfriend or girlfriend feels being around you flows out of your heart. I counseled one couple where the girl was going crazy. She's like, how do I get this fool to believe me when I tell him I love him? I tell him, he's like, you don't really love me. Nobody loves me. I'm so insecure. And after a while, she's like, I'm tired of it. I love him, but I'm sick of being doubted. And he's so boring in this way. He's so weak as a man. I'm starting to lose respect for him. And I'm like, wow, something's wrong with that brother's heart. Because no amount of saying it will convince him that he's actually loved. And out of his heart, he is killing a perfectly good relationship. His girlfriend can't stand to be around him because he, like a black hole, sucks all the life right out of her. And she's tired. And I thought that could have gone a very different way, except that it couldn't, because his heart guarantees that every relationship he touches will be touched by that same poison. It's contagious. Out of your heart flows every other thing in your life. So if you don't guard your heart, you have lost the battle for your whole life. You may think that the reason everything breaks down is because of a thousand weird coincidences where the universe seems to be in a conspiracy to rob you of joy. What nonsense is that? You know, there's an old saying, wherever you go, there you are. You are the common denominator in every scene. And the reason it all breaks down is not because everybody you come around screws you over, stabs you in the back, decides to take your joy. That's not, nobody had a meeting without you and said, let's ruin their life. Everybody got it? On five. Let's go. Nobody's doing that to you. Wherever you go, you carry your heart with you, and it's the lens through which you look at and interpret everything. That doesn't mean there's no such thing as real pain. But if you don't bring your real pain before somebody who can bring truth and meaning to that pain, all you'll do is see the lens clouded over with plaque, and you won't be able to see anything. And everything you touch after that will be poisoned by a heart that is shriveling and dying and living in an atmosphere of untruth. So I think it makes sense. I think, in fact, it is critically important that we sit regularly for examination under God's careful eye. Now, I'm not talking about daily devotions where so much of it is us studying. Now, I'm Asian, and I come from a culture where studying is redemption. Everything good is studied. And so you study, 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 write down, journal, you underline, highlight. Look at my Bible. I've got six different colors, one for different participles. And, you know, we love that kind of stuff. I'm not saying it's without value, but it's different. When I talk about quiet time, I'm not talking about a frenzied, frenetic activity where I'm reading, underlining, highlighting, recording, journaling. I'm also not talking about prayer where I'm just in an unbroken stream of words. You know, you get in that rock and you just get going, the flow. You're freestyle rapping at God, all monologue, bam, 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 bam. God, don't talk, I'm in the middle of it. And you're giving God all of this. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about really quiet time where for once you shut up. Shut up. Stop talking. Stop rehearsing. Stop telling everybody how it is and let God tell you how it is just for a couple minutes a day. Shut up. I know that sounds a little rude, but I really mean it. I mean, just be quiet. Time is the most unquiet time for most of us, unless you're sleep. Pastor, I had the most quiet time today. I mean conscious, awake, and quiet. Quiet because instead of me constantly needing to craft the story, to manage my version of things, I'm just saying, God, how do I lie to you? You know everything. You even know what was in the other person's heart. I can only guess at it, and I already have, but only you know the reality of this situation. Come, speak to me while I stop talking. Let me have bigger ears than a mouth just for this moment. And when you sit for that kind of examination, let me give you a few points of guidance that I think are important for that time with God to be of any value to your life. The first piece of advice is don't be dishonest. Okay, don't be dishonest when God is questioning you, probing you, examining you. In a recent dentist visit, I just got to tell you, I have the worst teeth in the world. My teeth are so bad, sometimes dentists look inside and just slap me out of being offended. How does anybody have teeth like that? Well, this dentist looked at my teeth, He's really polite. He was the most polite dentist I've ever had. Most of them, they go, it's a really rude sound, like a total shock. I'm like, I know. Well, this dentist looked at me, and he just went, and he asked me a question. He goes, Dave, do you brush thoroughly at least twice a day? And I was all offended. I'm a grown man. What do you mean, do I brush? I brush three times a day. Of course I brush. I rinse, I floss, and I was all offended until I realized how stupid that is. Maybe I think I brush thoroughly two or three times a day, but if I really brushed to his standards, he wouldn't be looking at my teeth going like that. All these weird clucking sounds of disapproval because he went to dental school, everybody. When he looks at my mouth doesn't lie. He already knows the story. He's not asking me the question because he's curious. He's trying to prompt a confession. He asked me the question as a nice way of saying, Dave, you really should learn how to brush your teeth more effectively and more faithfully. The question itself was not meant to say, I'm curious and I don't know. Will you tell me the truth? It is to say, I already know the truth. I'm wondering if you do. I'm wondering if after the offendedness and the indignation you feel, you can actually be quiet enough to say, I guess if my version of things were true, my life wouldn't actually look like this. I mean, there was one guy I was discipling, and he had some serious unfitness issues. His lifestyle was terrible. And I said, look, do you at least get up from your computer chair once in a while to move physically something? He goes, oh yeah, I work out all the time. Brother, I just don't think that's true, man. Because we just walked up the stairs and you're like, hold on a minute. And I'm like, yeah, you know, I just something about that observation and this claim that I work out all the time, it's not working for me. Something's not right there. And maybe in your mind, because you thought about working out all the time, been there, thought that, maybe that's how you live. Intention equals having done. But I think it's important for us to stop being so dishonest. And truth be told, myself included, I think most human beings are pathetically dishonest, even with themselves. It's hard for us to really see the truth about ourselves. You know, here's an experiment you can try that will really bother you and disturb you in a very deep way, okay? At some point, and I try to do this every couple months, stare in the mirror and make unbroken eye contact with yourself for like 10 minutes. 10 minutes, this is a long time, okay? It's a long time, because the first couple minutes you're like, all right, I could do it, it's no big deal. But at 10 minutes, you start seeing yourself and really disturbing things start to happen. Okay? When you make unbroken eye contact with yourself, at some point it almost becomes like looking at somebody else. You finally start looking at you and go, seriously, who the heck are you, man? This is the face everyone looks at. Are you truthful? Are you honest? Do I even know who you are when you're not busy telling everybody who you are? It's hard making eye contact with other people. I mean, if I told you, just turn to your neighbor right now, wake him up, and just look, don't look away. See, you can't do it, right? You can't even make unbroken eye contact without getting a little inappropriate for more than like 30 seconds. Eye contact is tough for people, right? Do you ever see the dance guys do at Fellowship Hall of Churches? They have to sit at oblique angles because when you turn to face him, he turns to do that. And if you do stop motion photography, here's what you see during fellowship. They're doing a do-si-do because it's like you can't just look at each other. We're not comfortable with that. But when you start really looking at yourself, after a while, you see a couple things. You see things about your heart, but you also start seeing things about your face. Dang, you're ugly. I mean, I thought I was kind of sexy. I'm looking and going, oh, man, your wife is a generous woman. And you're aging. Look at your eyes. Wrinkles. I didn't notice that before. And one eye is smaller than the other one, and it's all jacked up looking. It looks kind of... The more you look at yourself, the more you start to see. And that's why most of us don't look at ourselves very much. So even when you're making these boastful claims about who you are, Do you really have the right, the moral authority to be so dogmatic about who you are? Do you even really have that available to you? Do you really know who you are? And on what basis? If I spent as little time with you as I do with myself, could I claim to really know you? You don't know me like that. You spend like a couple minutes together at church once a week. You act like you know me. Well, how much time do you really spend with you? Really understanding yourself. Really knowing yourself. I know you're there every scene of the film. You know, I must be the star because I'm everywhere in every shot. So you're with yourself physically, but I mean really with yourself. Learning yourself. How much do you do that? And the truth is not very much at all. So when people accuse you of something or come against you and you're so defensive and all that, how well do you really know yourself to not wonder, could they be telling the truth and I'm the one who's deluded? David goes to great lengths to talk about how much God really knows us already. Oh Lord, you have searched me and known me. So it's funny, he's making the invitation when in the first verse, he already opens with, it's already done. You know when I sit down and when I rise up, you discern my thoughts from afar. Here's another one. You search out my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Do you know what that means? It's like when you see a couple that's been married for a really long time and the wife rolls her eyes like, oh, here he goes again. That story about that fish and all, oh my Lord. Because you know what? She knows his ways. She knows what he's doing. She knows exactly. And it's like that. God's like, oh, here we go. You act like I don't. I know your ways. When you start a sentence with that line, I know exactly what's coming next is a fat lie, man. I know your ways. You can't play a player. I know. I understand where you're going with this. Even before a word is on my tongue. I already know what you're going to say. Before a word is on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all together. What that means, the all together part, is you not only know the word, but you know whether the word is truthful or not. From what part of my heart that word arises, you know everything already. In other words, when God examines you, he's not lacking any data. Everything is laid bare before him. He already knows everything he needs to know about you. In fact, he knows you better than you know you. So when he examines you, to be dishonest, to be evasive, to pretend and be in denial is so pointless because you're in the presence of somebody who cannot be fooled or sold anything. He already has the truth plainly available to him. And in these heart exams, God's going to ask you some questions. He sees what you can't see. Can you see your own heart? But a doctor can when he shoots a picture like this. By the way, for those not in pre-med, your heart isn't actually shaped like that. Just wanted to make sure, you know, all the engineers are like, oh, that's amazing. It doesn't really look like that, okay? He's going to ask you questions like, why did that, what that person said, why did that bother you so much? I mean, really, why were you so upset about it? Because, no, shh, don't answer right away. That first answer is a stupid one. It's the one you're trying to get everyone to believe. Really think about it. Anybody who answers too quickly is selling you something. Most important answers come after a long, long time of reflection. Really, why? Not why do you want me to think it bothered you, but why did it actually bother you? Do you guys ever see, do you guys know the comic duo Key and Peele? Oh my gosh. Two of the funniest guys in the United States right now. They're geniuses. And they have this one skit about bullying where the guy's bullying, but instead of like covering it up, he's telling the actual psychological and sociological reasons why he's doing the bullying. It is hilarious. It's a little crass, but it's what I'm talking about. There's like the actual reason and then the reason that we are comfortable living with. That level of honesty is rarely seen in our world. What is it that you really want, God might ask? Where are you really trying to take this story, this relationship? Why haven't you left yet? Why didn't you go? What are you afraid of? What do you hope that nobody discovers about you? He's going to ask questions. And I think this is one of the ways that God most effectively elicits the truth, is not with declarations, but with questions. Because the answers you ultimately provide are the ones that you will own the most deeply. And a good doctor, when they're examining you, are asking you tons of questions, aren't they? Does this hurt? No. Does this? Yeah, that hurts. How much does it hurt when I do this? And they're asking questions because they're trying to get you to help tell the truth. God will ask you questions, and if you listen honestly, some of the questions will sting, but they will begin to get at the truth that God already sees. And he's asking them for your sake, which leads me to the second piece of advice, is when God is examining you, don't be defensive. It's kind of related to don't be dishonest, right? Because God already knows everything, there's not much point in being defensive. Look, if your doctor said to you, if my doctor said to me, Dave, you have diabetes, it'd be so stupid for me to be like, shut up, you have diabetes. I don't have diabetes, you have diabetes. Wouldn't that be so stupid? Why would that be stupid? Because she's not accusing me of having diabetes. She's informing me of it. It's not an insult to be taken personally. It's a piece of medical fact, and it's going to affect me. Why would we be defensive towards somebody who is really trying to tell us, do you know you got a little... There was one time, I just couldn't ignore it. I was at a mall, and I saw this girl. She was wearing black jeans and white underwear, and I knew it because her fly was just wide open. Just like big, giant, oval-shaped white cotton. And she's embarrassing herself. How could nobody else have said anything? She's been walking around the mall all this time. So I walked up to her and I said, excuse me, I don't want to embarrass you, but your flies are completely wide open. You might have just turned to the side. She looked at me like, pervert, whatever. Why don't you stop? Why don't you take a picture? I'm like, look, why are you attacking me? You're a fool with your underwear showing. What's the point of attacking me? Why would I make it my business unless I'm trying to tell you, stop embarrassing yourself? It's all hanging out. What is that? Don't you know how to get dressed in the morning? Don't you have a mirror in your house? Don't you have a friend? And she's attacking me. And I thought, well, what's the value to her to attack me? She hasn't paused to consider what my motives might be for pointing it out. She instantly assumed the worst because she was embarrassed. I get that. People are embarrassed. They're not at the top of their game. But we do that even to God. I mean, even when God points stuff out, half the point of retreats and wrestling and prayer and all that is the wrestling match of finally being able to accept what God has to say. It's not that we don't understand his English. It's that we don't like what he's saying. It's mostly hard to accept, not hard to understand. Do you remember in Dumb and Dumber when Jim Carrey's character was trying to get after Lauren Holly? And she's like, if you're the last man on earth. He goes, so you're saying that I have a chance. He couldn't accept what she was trying to say, so he kept interpreting it around his persistence. That's what we do. And we get so defensive when anyone tries to point out to us things that are creating a wake of destruction behind us. Listen to what David says. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. And I think the powerful meaning behind those verses is, whenever we are exposed, our first instinct is to hide, to evade, to cover up. When people share uncomfortable truths with you, our most common instinct is to avoid that person like they've got leprosy. Oh, here they come. I don't want to hear it. And you dismiss and you disqualify that person's voice by saying what they said was untrue and hurtful. I'm not going to listen anymore. Now, sometimes that's necessary. Sometimes you actually have an evil person trying to undermine your heart. Have a little wisdom. But if you know that this is a trusted person, someone you call friend, and they are saying things that are hard to hear, don't act like all the years of friendship got disqualified by your pain. That is a person who has earned the right to be heard. But our common instinct is to evade, to flee, to hide so that we don't have to hear it anymore. Because we think if we don't have to hear it, it won't be true. When one doctor tells you you got cancer, you get a second opinion. When the second doctor tells you you got cancer, you get a third opinion. And when the third doctor tells you that you have cancer, you stop going to see doctors. Why? Because we cannot accept the diagnosis. And so we hide from those who speak it. And that wouldn't be, it wouldn't surprise me if even in this room there are people whose hearts are already telling them, keep everyone at arm's length. Don't let anyone so close that they think they have the right to speak into your life. Because if you run far enough, you'll be away from everybody. And then everyone will only kind of know you, and no one will really, really know you. It's a defense mechanism many of us learned because we grew up in a toxic and pain-filled environment. Everyone around us that was supposed to protect us hurt us, starting with our parents. And so it may be that very understandably you've got a flight instinct built into you. But what about God? When you haven't misunderstood him, has God ever been out to get you? To wound you, to hurt you in a way that's malicious? Has God ever had it out for you where he thought, what would make my day is to ruin yours? God has never, ever had that heart for us. And yet we still try to hide even from God. You know, I think the lack of having real quiet time with God, it's not just a lack of discipline issue. I really think subconsciously at the heart of it, there's the desire to flee and hide from God. If I never sit in front of God, I never ever have to risk the possibility that he will tell me things I can't bear to hear about myself. So if I just turn up the music, roll down the windows, keep the wind coming through my hair, maybe I'll get through this life never really having to hear anything. How many of you, every time you get in the car, the radio comes on? In fact, it never gets turned off. With the ignition, the radio starts. How many of you? You're like, I wish I had a car, right? You're students. I try very hard not to have the radio on when possible because quiet is so rare in my life. Like I said, I have 4 children and 2 dogs. It's never quiet in my house. But sometimes the reason we don't let it get quiet is because we're hiding from every voice that could speak. When God is trying to get after you, he's not doing it to attack you. He's doing it to tell you, if you don't wake up to this, it will kill you. It will take from you everything that is precious. And you will wonder, why does every, I have the opposite of the Midas touch. Everything I touch turns to poop. Every relationship, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to turn you into poop, but it's what I do. It's my special gift to the world. Everything I touch turns into pain, anguish, regret. It's just how I am. And sometimes we start accepting it like it's a part of our traits, like our identification. But really, it's because we have a disease that never got diagnosed properly, never got treated. So everywhere I walk, out of that broken and filthy heart, a life is being formed. A life is flowing out. If I said to you, this water cooler is perfectly great, it only has 4 parts per million feces in it. Have a drink. I wouldn't drink that. Out of a filthy container comes filthy drink. I don't mean just moral filth. I mean all the gunk, that stuff that touches everything. It's in there. And when God wants to show it to you, he does it because he loves you. David confesses, you watched me as I was being formed in utter seclusion. As I was woven together in the dark of the womb, you saw me before I was born. Every day of my life was recorded in your book. Every moment was laid out before a single day had passed. This is the God who examines you. Is the one who lovingly crafted you, knit you together molecule by molecule, cell by cell. He made you in seclusion, even while your mother was just busy barfing and eating everything in sight. It's not like your mom's going, I made a nervous system today. No, she didn't. She just sat there and God made a nervous system. Even while your mom was bearing the indignities of pregnancy, God saw you inside. He's like, all right, I'm going to give you curly hair. Let's go. And he was making you. It's this God who also wants to keep making you. And so your defensiveness is out of place. Because you can't treat God as one who is out to ruin your life when he's the one who gave you your life. Every desire in the heart of God for you is benevolent. He is only love all the time. You can mistrust everybody else if you choose to, but you cannot mistrust God. He has not earned your mistrust ever. And so I'll understand if you have to learn slowly to let people speak into your life. But if you don't let God speak into your life, you don't know what you are losing and how much disease is festering in your soul because you never let God tell you how you're sick. Let me give you, so far it's been kind of a depressing sermon, so let's turn the corner. The last piece of advice is don't be depressed. Look, not all the news you hear from a doctor is going to be welcome. Sometimes he'll say things to you that you're like, phew. We just had a little girl, 4 years old at our church, who was just diagnosed with a brain tumor the size of a billiard ball. It was wrapped around her brainstem, and they just removed most of it. They couldn't scrape off all of it because otherwise they threatened the central nervous system functions, and you don't want to mess with that. So she's just gone through her first radiation treatment. Her hair is all, like, falling out. The kids at church had to have a special session just to teach them what she's going through so that they don't, like, freak out or say hurtful things about her. I remember being with the father the day they went to the hospital. Those things are not easy to hear. Your daughter has a brain tumor at 4 years old. It's devastating news. But we just needed a pause to remember, how good is it that we didn't hear this news in rural Appalachia, where the next doctor over is 60 minutes drive in a fast car, and he has no idea how to treat a brain tumor? How good is it that we found out this news and we happen to be in the vicinity of one of the best children's hospitals in the entire world? And that we caught it in time, that they were able to excise the tumor and give her a very, very good prognosis for her future. You see, it's one thing to receive devastating news, but if you pause and think about who's delivering the news, he's not just somebody who goes, you're sick, it sucks to be you, see you later. He's not a guy delivering a subpoena or summons to court. You Dave Lee? Here. Like, that's not how God acts. He goes, look, you're very sick, but I'm a very good doctor. Who would you rather hear it from? Would you rather hear it from somebody who has no power or from somebody who knows how to cure what you have? It is not always pleasant to hear negative news. But if anyone's going to deliver that blow, I'd rather it be the great physician, the healer of all things, the one who has all power, all resource available at his disposal, should I only submit myself and receive it. Life is full of bad news, whether you are a Christian or not, whether you listen up or not, life is full of bad news. Sometimes you hear it early, sometimes it kicks your butt out of the blue. Is there anybody who can buy their way out of bad news for the whole of their life? No. We're so afraid of it, but you can't dodge it forever. It will catch up to you. All of you will suffer in this life in some grievous way. And so will I. But who better to hear it from than the one to whom we can turn and say, "What can you do for me? That's awful. What can we do about this? I don't want to hear that as my death sentence. What then can we do?" And the one who gives you the diagnosis also has the therapy. Look what David says. You know, search me and try me in the Hebrew are very invasive words. It's not like ask me a couple questions. It's like cut me open, dig around. Really. Any of you old enough to have ever had a prostate exam? Men, let me just tell you right now, it's going to be the worst thing you as a male will go through for a long time. I had to do it. Can you just say my doctor was an older guy, he's in his late 70s. He had the shaky hands and he really needed to clip his nails before he'd be doing stuff like that. And the too much? Oh, but see, here it is, okay? It's invasive. It is so undignified and uncomfortable. But when he told me afterwards the result, I needed to know that result, didn't I? I had to clean his, you have an extraordinarily healthy prostate. Well, thank you. I work hard at it, you know, I do prostate workouts every, what am I supposed to, I just thank you. That was the grace of God. But a member of my church just finished getting therapy for prostate cancer. For him, the exam had a very different result. But the invasiveness is a part of it. But then he says this, and see if there's anything wrong with me. Why? Because then you are the one who can lead me in the way everlasting. He's not saying, tell me what's wrong with me and then just leave. He's saying, tell me what's wrong with me because I don't want to keep going down that path. If you tell me what's wrong, I can follow you out of this. You can lead me in the way that is everlasting. Just help me not to get stuck here forever and lose all of it. And so I encourage you, don't be afraid of what God has to say. Don't be depressed by the diagnosis because the one who's broken the news to you is the only one who can repair you. You cannot repair yourself. Now let me wrap up with just a couple practical things, okay? Do you guys like practical stuff, what you can actually do? Well, let me give you one little piece of advice. If you want to be in front of God and be examined, you've got to learn to be still. A couple years ago, I was playing football with our church against another church, and I'm one of those guys who when I start playing sports, I lose my stinking mind. I forget that I'm old, and I still think I'm like 20. And we were playing football, and I went for a first down. It's an inter-church football game, not the Super Bowl, but I was a wide receiver. We had an opportunity for a first down. Fourth down, we went for it. So I dove for a ball. I made a spectacular diving catch, landed within range of first down, and landed on both my kneecaps. I heard something, but I got up and I was like, oh, all right, I'm fine. Next play, I started running and I had a cut inside. And when I cut, I'd heard something worse. And I fell over. My legs turned spaghetti and I fell over. It turns out that two of the ligaments inside my knee, not my ACL, but the PCL and the MCL that run underneath the leg, they snapped in half. And I couldn't walk. I was just like, oh, what is going on? And they took me to the hospital and then they said, you have to take an MRI. You got to understand, I drink a lot of coffee. I'm kind of an agitated person. It's really hard for me to sit still. And the technician was this sort of snooty girl. She kept going, Mr. Lee, you have to sit still. If you don't sit still, the picture doesn't resolve properly. We got to take it all over again. On a good day, this MRI procedure would have taken 45 minutes. Okay? But because I kept moving, it took twice that long. I prolonged my torture because I could not sit still. And she would keep coming on the intercom going, Mr. Lee, you have to sit still. I was like, girl, you don't understand how hard it is. But I realized if I don't do it, I can't see clearly what's there. The fidgeting gets in the way. And I'm wondering, where is the stillness in your life? And stillness comes in a couple ways. You've got to make time for it. If you choose the wrong time, you can't be still because you're in such a rush to get to what's next. You know what I'm talking about? That's why cramming is such a bad way to study, but it's the way you all study anyway, right? Cramming is bad because it's like this, you're trying to get your brain to concentrate while you keep slapping the face going, it's tomorrow, it's tomorrow, it's tomorrow, it's tomorrow. And how are you supposed to relax and internalize information when every 5 seconds, it's tomorrow, it's tomorrow, it's tomorrow, it's tomorrow. But relax and absorb the information. Some of you are such like, you're like, I actually do better when I cram. You really don't. If that's how you study and you're an engineer, tell me which bridges you make so I can avoid them. Okay? Nobody performs better cramming. You might get a grade, but I don't want you touching anything that people's lives depend on. You're dangerous. You can't get the real deal if you don't know how to be truly still. And that requires time. It requires space. And here's the neglected part. It also requires environment. Environment is terribly important. I'm neurotic about keeping my space neat because if I see clutter, my brain immediately follows it. I can't. And I visited some guys' apartments in college. I don't know, what's wrong with you guys? It's like you were raised in caves. You become like primitive beings. Girls, don't ever use the bathroom in a guy's apartment. There's stuff growing behind there that's come alive. It's gonna evolve legs and walk away one day. Barbarians, right? The order, the cleanliness, the peacefulness of your space has a lot to do with what you feel inside, like it or not. You guys who study with music piped into your ears and try to do devotions with music piped into your ears, cut it out. Cut it out, seriously. You've so conditioned yourself to live with noise that quiet actually works against you. But you need quiet so that the voice of God rises above the clamor of this world. And some of us are intensely suspicious and uncomfortable about quiet. Do you have a place and a time and a space in your life where quiet happens regularly? I think one of the two most wasted times of our day are the moments right after we wake up and the moments right before we fall asleep. To me, those are the golden moments for my reflective times with God where he examines me. And here's a good piece of advice. Set your alarm 30 minutes before you need to get moving. And after your alarm wakes you up, lay in bed awake and just stare at the ceiling for 30 minutes. Don't move. Don't take a shower. Don't do anything. Don't even relieve yourself, okay? Your bladder can hold it for a little longer. Just sit there and spend 20, 30 minutes listening for God's voice, thinking about the days that's to come. Say to God, don't let me miss a single opportunity to find you in this day. Don't let me walk past somebody in need of you and not notice how they're hurting. And you just take that time to just be reflective. Because most of us, what do we do? We hit the alarm button after the first three snoozes, right? You actually wake up, and the first thing you do is you move. Roll out of bed instinctively in the same direction, go to the bathroom, go through the same routine in your sleep. I'm in such a routine that when I meet people for breakfast, I sometimes find that I've driven to work and have to go back to the restaurant because I'm like, I'm on autopilot. And those are great moments to just sit and say, before the rush of the day starts, still yourself and let God begin to search you. It's a little different because that's more of a preparatory time. But those last 20 minutes or so before you fall asleep at night, those are the best times to be defenseless and to let God tell you the day you just lived. And a lot of times, God will tell me things about me that I really, really don't enjoy hearing, but it's just before I fall asleep that I hear them. The other day, I'll give you an example of what I hear. The other day, I'd gone to like a cocktail party setting, and what the Lord said to me at night before I fell asleep was, you are so full of yourself. You will walk into that party completely disinterested in meeting people and really getting their story. You are so concerned that everyone there be impressed by you. Think that you're capable. Hear your stories. You are so busy trying to cultivate your image with these strangers that you didn't take a moment to think about what their lives are like. You stopped being a pastor. And I thought, man, that's convicting because the more, and you know, right before I fall asleep, it's hard to fight. I'm like, all right, if you say so. Just let sleep come. But it was so convicting. So convicting. And I really just, in the morning, I had to repent of that because I realized sometimes I'm so full of myself. And it's more important to me that other people know me than that I get to know them. I think that's why people feel pushed away by me. Do you have a time of the day when you let God tell you what your day was like in his eyes? What he saw in you that only God could tell you without you becoming fightful? If you need structure to go through this daily heart exam, let me give you a few suggestions here. Start by inviting God to search you. And Pastor Ben, I'm going to just take 3 more minutes with this and then we'll be done. Time, okay? Just invite God. I think like, it's like God is sometimes like a vampire. He can't really come in until you invite him, right? Like he can barrel in anywhere. But when you invite him, something powerful happens. Is God here right now? He's omnipresent. He's in the rings of Saturn while he's here right now. I mean, we got to believe that. He's omnipresent. But we say, God, we welcome you here. Why do we say that? Because we're theologically ignorant? No, we say it because we're saying when we invite him, something powerful happens in us. What it says is, I'm ready for you. I want you to be here. And then we pray, help me accept whatever you reveal. That's very important because I'm not always ready to hear it. I can invite him, but then sometimes he comes and I'm like, oh. So say, God, help me accept whatever you reveal to me today. And then here's what we do next. We listen, but we're not listening just for statements. We're especially listening for questions because the questions prompt confession. It's God uses questions because it's one of the powerful ways that God works to get us to the place we're supposed to be. He wants us to own the process, to be a part of it, not just to hear us getting whacked by his proclamations. So listen for questions. And before you're too quick to answer, let the question marinate a little bit. It's a very dangerous question you just asked me, God. Reflect deeply before answering. I just said that. And then ask God, ask him what he wants you to see or feel or believe or do. Say, okay, God, I heard your questions. I've been reflecting. What is it that you want me now to understand from that question? I have some answers, but I also want to know why you asked it. You know, do you ever have somebody ask you, like somebody who you don't particularly enjoy spending time with, and they go, hey, what are you doing tomorrow night? and you're trying to find out why they're asking, you completely miss the point, because they're like, oh, you're really busy. Okay, because I had like front row seats to the Bulls game I was going to give you, but you sound really busy. I'll give them to somebody else. Drat. I missed the point of the question. I assumed something, and I lost out. So just ask him, okay, I think I know why you're asking, but what is it you want me to see? Why did you ask the question of my heart? What am I supposed to see here? And then if you get an answer back from God, something that convicts you, make sure you write it down somewhere. And say, God, I want to think about one concrete next step, which I can take to respond to what you've just shown me. Okay? If your doctor says your cholesterol is very high, if you don't exercise, you're going to die. And you go, very convicting. And then you buy a box of Twinkies on the way home and you take a nap. That is not why he told you that. You need to actually start moving. And even the greatest, most complex endeavor begins with one next step. It does. Everything worth doing in life can be reduced to the very next doable thing, which will get you on the road. Everything. Even the launching of a space shuttle begins with one concrete next step. What about for you? Samuel Johnson said, "The road to hell is paved with good intentions." It's the story of some of our lives. We have some of the most poetic good intentions. None of them get realized because we have trouble with execution, with follow through on what God shows us, what others show us. So be ferociously committed to follow through in your journey with Christ. Don't just hear things and nod wisely like a wise kung fu master. It's not the purpose of revelation. It's for you to go, I see. He wants you to know so you can live. You can change your direction. And then one last step I didn't put on there is it's really good to share it with somebody so now it's alive. And someone more diligent than you can whoop you if you drop the ball. It's a really good idea to share it with someone you trust to follow through with you. Okay, are we okay? Still awake? I want to really encourage you not to blow this off. Make this a regular practice in your life. You would be amazed what God will do in your life if you begin carving out time and space to make a priority of letting him examine your heart. Tremendous things will happen in your growth personally as you let God do this in you. Why don't we bow and let's pray together. I think I've done more than enough talking this morning. My voice is not really the voice you now really need to hear. So why don't I just take us into a time of listening for God's voice? I just want to bless you in prayer as we go into that. God, we live in such a noisy and hectic world. It's so hard to get still and to get quiet. Some of us have spent years running, not towards you or with you, but in fact running away from you, running in spite of you. And so now, invite us, just like you invited Lazarus to come out of the grave, invite us in a way where the invitation has power. Invite us to be still before you, to stop our wriggling and our squirming, and to be still before you. And then, Spirit of God, come and speak, for we will listen. Speak the truth to us. Help us not to fight you as you tell us the truth. For we want you, the great physician, to heal what ails us and to repair what is broken. So come, God, as we set aside this time. Be present here and speak. In Jesus' name.